This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Let's go. Yeah. Hello and welcome to Unbought and Unbossed, Canadian political news and views. This is show number 109. Today is February 18th, 2009. Unbought and Unbossed is an independent voice dedicated to presenting and discussing the political and social issues most relevant to Canadian citizens. This show contends that 9/11 is Canada's single most important issue because the self-inflicted attacks of 9/11 are being used as the justification for the overthrow of our democratic and sovereign nationhood, turning Canada into a corporate-driven plutocracy. The official story of the 9/11 terror attacks and the ensuing war of terror are deeply troubling and are at the forefront of this radio program. I strongly encourage listeners to question what you think you know about today's world events and to analyze the motives behind our traditional news sources. Each week, new segments of Unbought and Unbossed offer further evidence for these incredible claims, which are either omitted or distorted by the mainstream corporate media. Turn your televisions off. You are being lied to and conditioned to accept this madness as our inevitable future. We must work to return the future of the human race to its rightful owners. That's you. Our ignore it and maybe it will go away on its own mentality is killing us. It has to end now. It is high time to wake up and to educate, to learn to work together, and to find the courage to act on our love for one another. Our every freedom is at stake in this battle for truth and accountability. The prize is nothing less than the health of our collective human soul. The revolution has begun. I suggest you find your role. Hey friends, how you doing? It's Raymond here. Unbought and Unbossed, show number 109. What do I have for you? We're going to start the show off with an interview, telephone interview with Bruce Ryder. He's a candidate with the British Columbia Refederation Party, the BC Refed Party. Bruce lives in Parksville or Qualicum, I'm not too sure which. He's going to be on the air shortly with us. We have an election, provincial election coming up May 12th. So we'll be talking a little bit about that. Okay, I've got a whole whack of audio clips today, and a good majority of these came from one of my favorite websites, and that's brasscheck.tv.com. And if you were to sign up, you would get nearly every day a video. And what they do is, yourself or myself, we could contact Brasscheck TV and say, hey, you know, there's this new video or new segment. I think it should, be on your website. And then sure enough, they get apparently tons and tons of emails, you know, by people like you and I that, you know, have found interesting information that needs to get out there. So that's what Brasscheck TV is about. I've attempted to contact the producers of this project to invite them onto the show, but they are really, really busy is what they say. They are so busy that that's not what they're doing right now, but that's okay. So there you go, brasscheck.tv.com. Check that out. So as far as audio pieces, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., yes, the famous Kennedy family, he's speaking, well, he's an environmental lawyer as well as a radio host, so he's probably pretty cool, right? Well, actually, I take that back. There's a lot of a lot of right-wing kooks, but that's okay. They call me left-wing kook. So Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is speaking on how the U.S. media is failing us, and indeed, so this fellow is speaking out. Recently, I think he has a couple books right now, but his last one was on environmental issues. Okay, I'm going to be reading a piece coming from PrisonPlanet.com. The author is Paul Joseph Watson, and it's concerning the Beijing skyscraper fire that happened earlier this month. And, well, this 50-story building burnt down like, well, it burnt, but it's still standing. That's the thing. And, of course, where we're going with this is that buildings do not turn into powder and dust when there are fires in them, even when they're, of course, I'm talking about the 9-11 buildings that turned into, well, the ones that were blown up. So it's looking at the debunkers and how full of shit they are, because a fire does not do the damage that happened on 9-11. And this Beijing skyscraper is a real good example of that. Okay, another audio piece. This is a commercial for a new book called The Undoing the Bush-Cheney Legacy, and it is put out by the Meiklejohn Civil Rights Institute, and it's looking at 67 different categories of laws that were affected or broken by the Bush-Cheney Legacy. And we have to ask, is Obama going to return America to a constitutional republic, or is it going to continue in this kind of fascist certainly comes up pretty quick in my mind of the form of government that is going on there. Very frightening. So that's a nice piece. And moving on. Oh, another piece I'm going to be reading from. This is by James Howard Kunstler, and it's called We'll Never Be Happy Again. No Stimulus Package Can Bring That Back. Kunstler is an American author, social critic, public speaker. He's best known for his books, The Geography of Nowhere, from 1994, which is a history of American suburbia and urban development, and more recently, The Long Emergency, 2005, where he argues that declining oil production is likely to result in the end of industrialized society as we know it, and force Americans to live in localized agrarian communities. I've read from that book on the show in the past. Okay, a movie review. This is for the film The Road to Guantanamo, looking at the torture that went on and I'm sure continues. You know, and that's an interesting thing, this whole Guantanamo thing. You know, apparently they're going to shut it down, but what about all the others? The other secret ones that are probably, who knows in how many countries? Well, we don't know, that's the thing. But we do know that they exist. Bush has said so. So, you know, Obama's going to pretend that he's the hero of the day and close down Guantanamo, but, you know, that's not going to solve the problem, is it? So Jonathan Kim is giving the review of The Road to Guantanamo. Okay, another audio piece. This is from one of my favorite mainstream media news personalities, Keith Olbermann. He's with MSNBC. And in this clip, he's speaking with Professor of Constitutional Studies, Jonathan Turley, and they're asking the question, will Obama make the changes needed to return the U.S. to a constitutional republic? And it seems pretty unlikely. That's what Keith Olbermann and his guest, Jonathan Turley, have come up with. So not too good a news there. Okay, let's move on to another audio piece. This is concerning the financial woes. And this piece comes to us from Congresswoman from Ohio, Marcy Kaptur. This piece was on CNN, and it's what it has to do. Marcy has a background in, real estate law, I imagine. And all these people are losing their homes and being kicked out to who knows where, in a lot of cases on the streets. But she's telling people to stay in your homes because due to the transfer of ownership deeds in these last numerous years, it makes it very difficult for them to show the proof, the deed, to who actually owns the house. So she's telling her constituents, stay there, and you're going to have that place probably for quite a few months before they can actually find the deed to say that this isn't your place. And apparently by law, they have to show the paper of ownership. So that's an interesting one. Another audio piece. I wasn't going to advertise this one. I was just going to play it. But the show previous to this, the gentleman guest brought this up. And, you know, kind of coincidence or conspiracy. And what we're talking about here is the streetcars in many American cities were replaced by the automobiles. And that did not happen by accident. It was indeed a conspiracy by, big moneyed interest to GM, Goodyear, and is it Standard Oil? I believe that trio systematically made it so American cities need to have automobiles. Okay, carrying on here, we're going to hear a piece by Scott Ritter, and it's called "New President, Same Bullshit." We're talking about Obama here. Boy, I guess I don't have a very favorable opinion of this fellow. This is concerning Iran and nuclear weapons. So who is Scott Ritter? Well, he is noted for his role as a chief UN weapons inspector in Iraq from 1991 to 1998, and later for his criticism of United States foreign policy in the Middle East. Prior to the U.S. invasion of Iraq in March 2003, Ritter publicly argued that Iraq possessed no significant weapons of mass destruction, and he was correct, wasn't he? So Ritter became a popular anti-war figure and talk show commentator as a result of his stance. Indeed, well done, Scott Ritter. I don't know, does that make him a whistleblower for telling the truth? I guess so, yeah. And there we are. So that's a lot of audio pieces and a couple others I didn't mention. So the interview, we're going to get Bruce Ryder with the BC Refederation Party. I'm going to get him on the air shortly. What we're going to hear right now, oh, this is a beauty. It makes you want to really question, doctors included. This is an old commercial. I don't know the year for this. Late 40s, early 50s is my guess. And it's, well, more doctors smoke Camel cigarettes, don't they? This is a brilliant piece, a lot of fun. Yes, question all authority, I think, is the moral of this. And we should still be questioning our doctors today. They're prescribing a lot of drugs that are doing a lot of damage to us, and that's unfortunate. So let's get this piece on, and I'll get Bruce Ryder on the phone. So stay tuned, folks. You're listening to the Unbought and Unbossed Show on CHLY. We're at 101.7 FM on the radio dial, and you can catch us live streaming on the internet at www.chly.ca. Okay, friends, back with you shortly.
Percent of the commercial network television time is paid for by the 100 largest corporations in North America. Some corporations have television budgets that range into the billions per year. Television producers compromise and end up mitigating their desires for those of the advertisers. Thus, television is effectively a private medium for their use only. The longer a person watches television, the more easily the brain slips into alpha level, a slow, steady brainwave pattern in which the mind is in its most receptive mode. Images and suggestions are implanted directly into the mind without viewer participation. An effective hypnosis is induced, and the viewer surrenders to the unending television image stream. Image images of television violence stimulate the fight-or-flight instinct. But since it would be absurd to react to television violence, the viewer suppresses the emotion. Viewers are drawn back and forth on cycles of impulse and suppression. When the set goes off, this stored-up energy bursts forth in frantic behavior commonly associated with childhood hyperactivity. Television imagery is jammed together in a steady stream of information, fracturing your attention while condensing and accelerating time. These events would not happen in ordinary life. They are technical alterations only possible within the moving image media. Living in the rapid world of television imagery, ordinary life is dull by comparison, and often far too slow. People who immersed in the surrogate reality of television life deal on a daily basis with a reality totally unlike any that has preceded it. The image stream is a steady, mixed-up stream of real, unreal, and semi-real events. All of these events end up merging with each other and becoming just another set of stored imagery that have all similar reality values.
You know what? Silly me, friends. That was a corporate media survival guide, and it presents how television works. And that was 3 minutes of really accurate information, and I was very impressed with that. So that more doctors smoke Camel cigarettes, that will come up after the interview. That's the one that I explained to you, but that's not what happened, is it? However, what is going down? I have with me on the other end Bruce Ryder, who is a candidate with the BC Refederation Party. Welcome to the show, Bruce.
Thanks for having me, Raymond.
Yes, absolutely. So we're coming up to an election before too long here provincially.
Yep.
May 12th.
Yep.
So you're going to be running in, is it the Parksville-Qualicum riding?
That's correct.
Okay, now where's the boundary line? I know my federal boundaries, but I don't know the provincial boundaries.
Well, the boundary line now, under the new distribution and setup, is that for Qualicum-Parksville, it starts at Mostar at the Island Highway.
Okay, so it does split Nanaimo.
And, yeah, it splits Nanaimo right at Rutherford Road, all the way up Rutherford Road, down to Hammond Bay. And then Hammond Bay along to Brickyard, and then Brickyard down to the water. That is the southern border of the riding. And then everything north of that to the Little Qualicum River, just on the other side of Qualicum, where the bridge is here when you go past that campgrounds and that there, before you climb the hill heading towards Bowser. That's the northern extremity. And mostly inside the line of the island highway to the water is also places like French to the Whiskey Creek and Arrington. Those, they're all in the Alberni riding. But French Creek, Qualicum proper, Parksville proper, Lanceville, North Nanaimo, all part of the Qualicum Parksville.
There we are. Very nice. Now you have a long experience, many years experience in taking part in various political initiatives. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background in politics and how it is that you've come to be with the BC Refederation Party, and then we'll take it from there after.
Sure. Well, I came to Nanaimo in 1981. We moved here, our family here. Before that, I was involved with some provincial parties, working in provincial elections and federal elections in the back rooms of parties. That's where I kind of got my first taste of the political situation. And at that time, I was with the New Democrats when I was much younger, and that night I worked on the provincial election with Bob Skelly. I worked on the provincial election, federal election with Ted Miller in those years gone by. And then we're in the back room, and then, you know, as a volunteer and a canvasser and et cetera, et cetera. And then we moved out to Nanaimo here, and I started our family and had our family, and I went into business here, And I got in, I was interested in how the mammal was going to grow and what have you. And so I thought I'd somehow, some way try and put my two cents in worth about it. And I ran for school board and was elected in late 80s.
Okay.
I ran a couple times in the municipal elections. Wasn't elected, but did run and tried to bring a point of view forward in that and try to just let people know that there's a different way of doing things and that. And but they weren't prepared to hear that at, as far as my candidacy was concerned, which is fine.
Okay.
And then when we had a little scandal here a number of years back provincially, where we had an NLA who was out of Parksville who was writing letters to the editors under an assumed name, running down other candidates, etc. And he was kind of found out, and we had had a recall legislation put in place, and it was one of the first tests of the recall legislation to be brought about. But as the recall action was rolling along, the MLA stepped down, resigned his position, and there was a by-election called, which I ran in that by-election on a provincial ticket as an independent. And I have run federally once independent. For the Lamo Alberni riding, and I, the last election in BC was the first election, excuse me, that we said BC fielded some candidates, and I happened to have been one of those candidates, and we ran in what was then the Parksville Aqualicum riding before the new designation, and here we are again 4 years later.
Right, right. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about the BC Refederation Party? How is it different? What's it, now, it's a fairly new party. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay, thank you. Yeah, Refed BC is was something that was brought about after a federal election about 6 years ago, where it just seemed to have some people that got together and said, how we just got to stop having this kind of election being finished before BC even gets a chance to put the votes in and have the seats counted. And half a dozen people or so sat down in a family room here in Nanaimo and said, so we've got to do something and do something different and try and present a different perspective of how we should be governing ourselves, and not only in this country, but in our province, and also what our relationship is between our federal government and our provinces. And out of that came this thing called Refed BC, and basically it's a way to govern ourselves based primarily on the Swiss model, which has been around for about 125 years. We're not out trying to reinvent the wheel or anything, but this is something that's proven and tried and true. And what it does do, it gives the people much more interaction with the everyday goings-on of government with respect to what government does in the passing of legislation and what the people require and or desire in the passing of legislation. And that's by having windows of opportunity between four-year election dates of going to a referendum to either put down legislation that government has brought forward that people do not want to have it, or to instill or bring forward legislation to which the government is being very slow about introducing and that people want it to happen.
Okay, okay.
So that's the basic model of that. Also, by having that kind of a system, we have to have, of course, a constitution, which our country, or in my opinion, my country doesn't have, and most definitely our province doesn't have, of how we govern ourselves and who is accountable to whom. And today it's people go in and have a vote every 4 years. You get your 5 minutes of freedom and democracy, and you get your 4 years of legislation, whether you like it or not.
And it seems to be more of the same as
well. Yeah, and in this way, this action taken by the provincial government here for this budget scenario, rescinding their own law about balanced budgets. Well, maybe some people think that's a good idea, and maybe a lot of people think it wasn't a good idea. But these guys can pass laws and rescind laws at will, but yet the people, if they have a law passed against them, they say, we don't want this law. We told you we didn't want this law. You told us you wouldn't pass the law. Anyway, they haven't passed the law anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And here we've got to sit here another 4 years and wait. Well, under the Swiss model, you don't have to wait 4 years. You got about every 90 days, every 3 months in Switzerland, they're allowed to bring referendums forward if there is the criteria met, which was the number of signatures from a number of writings, et cetera, come okay. together to require that vote to come forward, that people have a say. And it's ongoing, and it has been ongoing in Switzerland for a long time.
Okay. Now, your website is refedbc.com, is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. And on that website, I saw the piece where it's suggesting that there would be four voting days set aside each year.
That's
and
right.
You partly just touched on that there.
That's
so
right.
They're calling it 16 chances in 4 years to guide your government.
That's right.
I like that a whole lot. Now, is you know how that would happen? Is there a way to maybe get more participation? Well, you would think that that would bring in more participation if Canadian voters or BC voters were taking part in creating laws or rejecting ones that they weren't in favor of.
Yeah, well, you would hope so, initially for sure. In Switzerland, like I say, it's been going on for 125 years now. So when they do have referendums, initially they're put forward by people who say, you know, I've had enough of this. I don't want this to happen anymore. There's an example here not too long ago, a lady... Her daughter was raped in Switzerland, and she wanted once and for all to have these rapists put in jail forever, never to see light of day. But there wasn't legislation in place for that, and the government was prepared to do that. She went out and organized her referendum, got all the applicable signatures she needed to have that referendum come about, and it went to a ballot, and the ballot went through, and the people came out, and they voted and said, yes, we agree with that. And the government is required, we'll take under advisement or we're not bound by this. The government is bound by that to bring in legislation to make sure whatever the terms of the referendum question was are brought into law. Or
wow.
If it's vice versa, taken off the books because the people have said no.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that sounds like fantastic legislation that I would like to see here.
It's direct democracy. It's the people have a real say, and if you agree with the issue, you know, you go out, or if there's enough agrees, you go out with it, and you vote for it. And if you disagree with it, you go out and do it. I know over time in Switzerland, if I take a look at some of the numbers. Again, there's been a drop in the number of people who turn out, but then again, people say, yeah, I agree with that. I'm not going to go vote against it.
Mm.
The peril of that is, of course, those that are against it come out and turn it down. Well, okay, that's the way it goes.
Right.
So that means you better be due diligent if you want something to be put into place, then you have to take your responsibility. You got to be responsible for your freedom. You got to be responsible for how you're governed, and that's what's happened in this province and in this country to some degree today, is that we are no longer taking responsibility for our government, and we have set them to do everything for us, instead of us saying, "Say we're the government, we're the power, the people are the power, not the politicians. It's the people that are the power, and the people will direct us."
Yeah, that's a big shift, and I don't think that's being taught in civics classes nowadays.
No, it's not. I don't think it is either, no.
Yeah.
And I know, and like, you know, you do this for a number of reasons. One, I do it for my kids, and they say, "Oh, and I had a guy today. I was talking to today. He says, why don't you just relax, Bruce, and enjoy your older years, and you know, just take it easy." You know what? I said, because right now my dad would be spinning in his grave if he knew he spent 6 years in the North Atlantic fighting the Axis, as they put it in quotations, and to see what this country's turned out to now. You know, and God bless his soul. My kids, I said, you know, I don't ever want to have to go out of this place one day and my something's going on and my son says, "Dad, why didn't you do something?" It was because I said, you know, Clinton, I tried to do something. I tried something to try to do something. And I got a little grandson now, the same thing. And I don't ever want to have to look them in the face and say, you know, well, it wasn't because I didn't try, you know, to try and make a change or try and make a difference. Maybe I went about the wrong way. Maybe it was not my time. Maybe I didn't bring my position forward in a coherent and proper manner, but at least I tried.
Yeah, good for you. Now, you're with a small party. How you've got a huge hill to climb.
Yep.
Tell me about the likelihood of a small party right now taking a seat.
Well, you know, wonders never cease in situations. Taking a seat, again, it's if we can somehow, some way have that... Well, what's the thing that they call the 100th monkey theory, the critical mass, somewhere along the line that there's a coalescence of the population, there's a coalescence of the international mind or the provincial mind of saying, hey, you know, yeah, we want to change. Yeah, you know, we're going to do something about this. You know, we're going to go out, we're going to support that candidate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like my last election, when they asked, you know, what's your chances of winning? I said, well, my chances are winning are slim to win. That's my chances. You know, that's exactly what they are. And we've seen that happen in other areas where guys have come out of nowhere. What happened there? How did they ever get in power? Because the people, somewhere in there, there was critical mass. Somewhere in there, there was that, you know, like I say, that the project of observation of the 100th monkey, or all of a sudden, hey, a whole bunch of people are doing this. Well, maybe we should do it. All of a sudden, everybody's doing it, and something changes. There's a change.
Yeah.
They did it in the U.S. this time. They did it. They had a change. No, they did a change. They elected the first black president in history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is that about in the United States? Whoever thought that would happen at this time?
Mm-hmm.
And there it is. You know, it's happened. So the forever optimist that I am, that I believe that, you know, I have to believe, because to think otherwise is unthinkable.
Okay.
That there will somewhere along the line someday come about a change, and it'll be the change of the universal consciousness about how we're doing this, how we govern ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I certainly appreciate that thought. However, the Obama, I don't see much change happening there other than the skin color. That's the only change I see.
Well, what I'm saying is that the concept. Now, let's hope, as we show right there, this is our plan. Now, we got a 100-day plan. We got a 6-month plan. We're gonna bring a constitution to the people of British Columbia and say, do you want to be governed this way, or do you not want to be governed this way? And you know what? You're going to have a say in how you're being governed. We know that when Australia brought their constitution forward after the 1931 Statute of Westminster, when the colonies were set free, they brought a constitution twice before the people said, yeah, we want to have that. And they did it in South Africa, and they did it in Ireland, and they did it in New Zealand. And we're the only country in the world that never went out and created a constitution and or province that created a constitution that was ratified by the people as to their permission on how they wish to be governed.
Yeah, yeah. Fascinating. I see proportional representation as perhaps the only in for the smaller parties. Is that something that BC ReFed is pushing?
No, actually not. It's a way for a small party to get in there, but you saw the furor in the this coalition aspect under the minority government in our federal situation.
Right.
And my observations, and in fact, you can even see it right now in Israel with the elections they just had recently in Israel, that these proportional representations, where if you get, you know, depending on the criteria, in Israel's case, it's 2% of the vote. If you get 2% of the vote, you get a seat.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter if you got a seat in any one riding by popular vote. If you get 2% of the vote, there will be a seat assigned for you into the House.
Okay, and you don't like that?
Well, to me, it brings about coalition governments. It brings about that uncertainty. You got a half a dozen guys saying, okay, we'll band together, but as soon as some guy gets a cold, the other five want to get out of town, and all of a sudden you collapse. So you end up in a, perhaps, or potentially, excuse me just a second, excuse me, potentially in an Italian situation where you're having an election every year for the last 46, 47 years.
Right. Well, it certainly requires a new form of cooperation within
the
government.
The thing is, if we were to have the model of the Swiss model, direct democracy, in there, it wouldn't really matter who you elected, because these guys aren't running the show. It's the people that are running the show, and these fellas that are going to be in there, and ladies that are going to be in the seats of government, are going to be there doing our business, not there doing their business to us, but us directing our business to them.
Yeah.
And they are the people or the vehicles to make sure that business to which we direct gets done.
Okay.
So we wouldn't necessarily need a proportional vote at that point because of that. And you still have first past the post, but there's an aside. And a personal, I'll say this from personal, it's not a party policy, but I would personally like to see a majority vote, and if you were to get down to the hardcore of voting, and that if you had to have a runoff election, and lots of countries do this, you have a runoff election, and it's 50% or 51% or whatever you decide to be, and that determines that the majority of the population wants this to be the leader. But we can live with the first past the post if we have this direct democracy model in place under a Swiss governing model.
Sure. Yeah, I see where you're coming with that now.
Excuse me.
How many candidates is BC Refederation Party hoping to run?
Well, our last count, we had 50 confirmed.
Okay.
And I think there's been a couple have had to back out since then, but there are still people coming forward in different areas to constituents that are still open. And we'll, from what I understand, the process will be left open until up to the date that we have to the nominations for candidates will be shut off. Okay. Can you just excuse me for a minute, Raymond? I got a tickle in my throat.
Yeah, absolutely. Take care of your thing.
Okay, we got her.
Very nice.
Thank you very much.
Well, we're nearing the end of our discussion, so if you would like to hit on any topic that you haven't yet, if there's anything, and any pieces yet to say?
Well, what we have to do is the people will take a look at Refed BC on website if they want to know who we are and what we're about. If there are people you hear all the time, we want change, you want change, it's going to be different. There's insanity out there because we keep going out and doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result, and we're not getting that. So we just say, well, we're here. We want to bring a different point of view, a different perspective, and we are going to use the form of a provincial election to do that. And if you think we got something to offer, well, then stand up, step up, and quit worrying about, oh, if I vote this way, that other guy's going to get in because they're... Vote your conscience. Vote your heart.
Okay.
And at least you'll be true to yourself, if nothing else.
Sure, sure. Okay, so don't play politics with politics, eh?
Basically. If you want change, if you want real change, that's what you have to do.
Okay. Okay, so the website is refedbc.com.
That's right.
And... well, I wish you the best and your party the best. The idea of a constitution in BC, and especially the idea of the four voting days a year, you know, that is a pretty neat idea.
And those days aren't, if you look at the Swiss model again, those days are not exercised. I mean, but they're there if there is a will of the population. There are those windows of opportunity over that period to come in and say, hey, you can't be doing what you're doing, or hey, you're not doing what we want you to do.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think, you know, the Liberals have, you know, very successfully, you know, selling the natural, you know, what owns to BC to multinational corporations.
Yeah.
You know, those are our resources, and no one gave them permission to do what they're doing. Very frustrating. So there is a huge problem going on with BC politics right now.
All I can say, Raymond, is power to the people.
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
Okay, well, I'm going to take some of your wishful thinking and try to pass some of that on.
Well, thank you very much for the time.
Okay, Bruce much Ryder, be well. Thank you, buddy.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good day. Okay, so there we are. Bruce Ryder, candidate with the Parksville-Qualicum riding in B.C. with the B.C. Refederation Party. The website is... so it's refed, R-E-F-E-D, B-C, refedbc.com. And they're suggesting less Ottawa, more B-C. Problems for B-C at the fundamental level require fundamental changes. So there we are, a new, a fairly new political party out there. So give them a visit if they are in your riding and you want to know more. So there we are. Okay, so this is the Unbought and Unbossed show. I'm your host, Raymond. We're going to continue on now with a couple audio pieces. With this, more Dr. Smoke Camel is coming up, and I got the my order back backwards on that, and that's going to be followed by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. speaking out on how the U.S. media and Canadian media is failing us desperately. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is an environmental lawyer and a radio host. So we'll be back to you to read the piece from PrisonPlanet.com on the Beijing skyscraper fire. The silence is deafening, and that's because that skyscraper did not behave at all the way the buildings did on 9/11. Well, because it wasn't blown up. That's the difference right there, isn't it? So, you folks be well out there, and I'll see you shortly.
You know, if you were to follow a busy doctor as he makes his daily round of calls, you'd find yourself having a mighty busy time keeping up with him. Time out for many men of medicine usually means just long enough to enjoy a cigarette. And because they know what a pleasure it is to smoke a mild, good-tasting cigarette, they're particular about the brand they choose. In a repeated national survey, doctors in all branches of medicine, doctors in all parts of the country were asked, "What cigarette do you smoke, doctor?" Once again, the brand named most was Camel. Yes, according to this repeated nationwide survey, more doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette. Why not change to Camels for the next 30 days and see what a difference it makes in your smoking enjoyment? See how Camels agree with your throat. See how mild and good-tasting a cigarette can be.
Should I add, kids, smoking's bad for you. Don't smoke. Don't be a dummy. All right.
We need a press that is doing its job, and it isn't. I mean, that is why, you know, we have the problem with the principal problem with democracy. There's two big failures. One is all the corporate money that's going into our election process. And the second failure is that we have a negligent and indolent press in this country that has simply let down American democracy. And you know, I travel all over the country and I hear people talking still, you know, people saying about talking about the liberal media. Well, that's what Joseph Goebbels used to call the big lie. If you just keep saying it and saying it and saying it, people begin believing it. There's no liberal media in this country. You know, what do you have? You have The Nation's Magazine, you have Mother Jones, you have Rolling Stone, you have Pacifica Radio, Air America, and then, you know, you have these two guys, and that's pretty much it. But we have a right-wing media in this country, and if you look around, that's where Americans are disproportionately getting their news. And, you know, the Pew Foundation recently did a survey that showed that 30% of Americans now say their primary news source is talk radio, which is 90% controlled by the right. 22% said cable news, mainly Fox News. 10% said Sinclair Network, which is the most right-wing of all of them. Sinclair is the largest television network in our country. It's run by a former pornographer who requires all 75 of his local affiliate stations to take a pledge that they will not report critically about this president, about the war in Iraq, or a number of other issues. And then the rest of us, only 11% of Americans now read papers, where you still can get some relevant news occasionally. But the rest of us get our news primarily from the traditional corporate-owned media, ABC, NBC, CBS, and CNN, which have no ideology except for their own pocketbooks. And that ideology is almost always coterminous with the ideology of the party in power, but particularly the Republican Party. Because, you know, they want all these consolidations, they're supporting these corporate consolidations. These are huge companies that have all kinds of subsidiaries that are looking for licensing deals and consolidation, you know, concessions from the government. And they're not going to say something that offends them. And, you know, there's no, you look on network television, there's no liberal equivalent of John Stossel or Glenn Beck or Robert Novak or Sean Hannity or Bill O'Reilly or any of these other guys. You know, you have, okay, you've got Alan Combs, you know, and that's just, I gotta read this thing that Randy read today. I mean, this guy is, you know, this is like, that show is like, you know, it's the Harlem Globetrotters, and he plays the Washington, you know, Generals. It's just, his whole job is to lose every argument. And he says, here's what he said when President Bush declared mission accomplished a year ago today. Now that the war in Iraq is all but over, shouldn't the people in Hollywood who oppose the president admit they were wrong? That's from our great, you know, liberal voice on the American media. So, what this devolution of the American press began in 1988 when Ronald Reagan abolished the Fairness Doctrine. We had a rule in this country that was passed in 1928 at the dawn of commercial radio, and that was called the Fairness Doctrine. That rule said that the airwaves belong to the public. The broadcasters can be licensed to use them, but only with the proviso that they use them to promote the public interest and to advance American democracy. There were three requirements under the Fairness Doctrine. Number one, they had to air issues of public import. That's why there's a 6 o'clock news hour on the networks. Not because they wanted it. They wanted to put entertainment in that slot. The news departments traditionally were money losers. So they were forced to do that as part of the fairness doctrine. That's why the radio stations periodically update you on the news. It's part of the requirement under the original fairness doctrine that they're still, you know, doing as a tradition. On number two, they had, if they were going to give opinion, they had to tell both sides. You couldn't have had a Fox News under the fairness doctrine. You couldn't have had a Rush Limbaugh. You could have had Rush, you know, 4 hours a day, but then they would have had to put somebody else on, a countervailing voice, for the next 4 hours. You couldn't have Rush and his ditto heads for 24 hours a day on the same station. And Rush Limbaugh got started in 1988, the year that Reagan abolished the fairness doctrine. Number three, they had to avoid corporate consolidation. Congress wanted to make sure that people in Kansas could get crop reports, that people in North Dakota could get tornado warnings, that people in the South could get country music, that you wouldn't have, you know, programming and content dictated by a couple of corporate epicenters in remote areas of the country. And that part of the fairness doctrine, incidentally, was strengthened in 1945, was fortified, because they saw what Congress saw, what Hitler had done in Europe and the other fascist governments had done, where they had allowed these corporate consolidations and they had given these contracts and special favors to the media, and they had co-opted the media and got them on their side, and so that anybody who criticized them was either muzzled or was branded as, you know, as unpatriotic. And they said, we can't allow that to happen in this country. So they strengthened that part of the fairness doctrine. Today, Ronald Reagan abolished the fairness doctrine as a favor to the Christian right, which was already plotting the takeover of AM radio, and as a favor to the studio heads who had helped him get elected, who were plotting the takeover of all media. And today, as a result of that, there are five giant international or multinational corporations who control all 14,000, virtually all 14,000 radio stations in America, all 5,000 television stations, 80% of our newspapers, all of our billboards, and most of the large internet content providers. So there are five guys who are deciding what we hear as news and information. And the news departments have become corporate profit centers. They no longer have an obligation to promote the public interest. Their only obligation is to their shareholders. And they serve that obligation not by telling us the difficult issues that we need to understand, like, you know, what happens when you privatize Social Security, and how did the pharmaceutical companies end up controlling Medicaid and Medicare, and, you know, what is global warming, and all of these issues, but rather by cutting costs. And guess what? Where did they cut costs? They cut costs by firing all of their investigative reporters. 80% of investigative reporters have lost their jobs over the past 15 years. The people who could connect the dots between the money that came from the corporate polluters to the White House, then the rollbacks that were engineered by the White House, and the children that you see, the asthmatic kids that you see in New York City and all over this country. Nobody's making those connections. Nobody's connecting the dots. So you see the asthmatic kid, and you're not saying the White House has something to do with that. The fact that in 19 states you can no longer safely eat any freshwater fish caught in the state because of mercury contamination coming from coal-burning power plants that were supposed to have removed 90% of that mercury 5 years ago, but the White House, having accepted $48 million from that industry, rolled back those rules so that now there are 19 states. All of the freshwater fish are unsafe to eat, and in 49 states, most or some of the freshwater fish, including New York, which most of them are unsafe to eat. The only state where all the freshwater fish are safe to eat is Wyoming, where the Republican-controlled legislature has refused to appropriate the money to test the fish. But in all the other states, some or most or all of them are unsafe to eat. According to CDC, one out of every six American women now has so much mercury in her womb, one out of every six, that her children are at risk for a grim inventory of diseases: autism, blindness, mental retardation, heart, liver, and kidney disease. My levels of mercury are 2.5 times what EPA considers safe just from eating fish. And all of this could have been stopped except that Bush abolished the mercury rule. But there's no, but Americans don't know that. I go and buy my fishing license for $30 a year, every year in New York State. And I get the fish advisories, which are now this thick, that basically say there's only, you know, a few place where you can safely fish in New York State. I read through that thing and I'm saying, that son of a bitch, George Bush. But most fishermen who buy that thing don't make the connection. The reason they don't make the connection is because there's no investigative reporters out there telling them about that connection.
Okay, there it is. That is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on how the media, U.S. and Canadian news media, fails us. And then he went into a little fishing tales there, didn't he? Boy, it only hurts when you laugh, eh? There we are. Well, let's move on to an independent news source. This is from PrisonPlanet.com. The author is Paul Joseph Watson, a regular contributor. And this is concerning the Beijing skyscraper fire. The silence is deafening. So let's get into that. 3 days after a towering inferno engulfed a 500-foot skyscraper in Beijing, debunkers have failed to come up with any answers as to why the building remained standing in comparison with World Trade Center Tower 7, which suffered a uniform 7-second implosion as the result of limited fires spread across just 8 floors on September 11. Beijing's Mandarin Oriental Hotel defied all known physics on Monday when it was consumed by fire but did not collapse, a modern-day miracle in light of the commonly accepted premise that since 9/11, all steel buildings that suffer even limited fire damage implode in on their own footprint within seconds. However, all joking aside, any credibility that remained behind NIST's thermal expansion theory, which was apparently only evident on one day in history, and not in the cases of hundreds of other high-rise buildings that have caught fire and remained standing, well, metaphorically, it went up in flames. It went up in the flames that consumed, but did not collapse, one of Beijing's most prominent buildings. The silence of debunkers with regard to the hotel fire is both deafening and highly hypocritical. Proponents of the government's version of events are usually feverish to seize upon anything, no matter how inane and off-tangent, in order to try to prop up the official 9/11 fairy tale. The best retort we have seen since the fire is the claim that buildings are constructed differently, and therefore no comparison can possibly be made between the Mandarin Hotel and Building 7. Well, that's just not the case. And he goes into a rather lengthy side piece, which I'm going to skip. So we'll start back in. I'll conclude this rather short article. So when debunkers attempt to evade difficult questions about the Beijing skyscraper fire by claiming that no comparison can be made to World Trade Center 7, it's pertinent to remind them that they considered it perfectly legitimate to compare towering skyscrapers with run-down, creaking bridges in order to push their agenda. The state-controlled communist media in China have all but censored coverage of the Beijing skyscraper fire to avoid public embarrassment. But the silence has been just as deafening in the U.S., where corporate media networks have largely ignored this story. Ostensibly to prevent people from making the obvious comparison to World Trade Center Building Number 7. But thankfully, an army of truth activists have been busy on YouTube compiling video comparisons of the fires in the two buildings and the resulting damage. So, minor, relatively little damage in World Trade Center 7, as well as Towers 1 and 2, and they all came down in powder versus this skyscraper in Beijing that burned amazingly from the pictures that I've seen, and it did not come down. So to look at those pictures and those videos, I will tell you what I do with this show is I do archive my shows in case you miss one or you want to find out who was on that show. You know, the songs, the media clips, the book reviews, all those things, you can find it all at my website, which is unbossed.livejournal.com. That's unbossed.livejournal.com. And what I do is I provide links as well to everything that you're hearing on tonight's show. So if you want to see those fires yourself, the link will be there, and you can just click on that.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
So, I think we're moving on now. Yes, we are. We're going to do the weather update. So let's get the weather song on. This is John Lennon's I Don't Want to Be a Soldier, Mama. So it looks like we have a couple sunny days coming out, so good for us. Let's go out and enjoy them. There we are. This weather update has been brought to you in part by three truth groups in Western Canada that support independent media. They are Edmonton 911 Truth, Victoria 911 Truth, and Fraser Valley 911 Truth. Thanks to those groups in helping to become the media, something we desperately need. This show covers a lot of stories about the problems of corporate media, and, well, these people are working to change that, aren't they? So, we're going to move on to an audio clip, and then I'll read another article. So this audio clip here, it is a commercial for a new book called Undoing the Bush-Cheney Legacy. So Undoing the Bush-Cheney Legacy, a toolkit for Congress and activists. That's the full title. And it has 67 categories of laws affected. So in addition to being a disaster for the economy, the environment, the military, and the nation standing in the world, the Bush-Cheney administration was a disaster for the rule of law. There is nothing more important for President Obama to do than to start reversing this damage immediately. Hear, hear. In fact, nothing could be a clearer indication of his sincerity in putting the U.S. back on the right track. The toolkit is put out by the Michael John Civil Rights Institute. So what they have done, they have documented all the laws that were routinely violated by the White House with congressional consent during the Bush administration. So they're suggesting that you get the book, Undoing the Bush-Cheney Legacy, inform yourself, inform your friends and colleagues, and demand that the White House and Congress immediately address the disastrous shredding the American law from the Constitution on down that took place during the Bush-Cheney administration. So this commercial was put together by Joseph Woodard Multimedia. So let's get on to that, and then I'm going to be reading from a recent article by James Howard Kunstler. The title is, We'll Never Be Happy Consumers Again. No stimulus package can bring that back. So there we are, friends. The Unbought and Unbossed show on CHLY 101.7 FM from Nanaimo. So let's move on to Undoing the Bush-Cheney Legacy.
Michael John Civil Liberties Institute decided to write this book, put this book together, actually edit it, because the Bush administration, Bush-Cheney administration, has done so many things more to destroy the Constitution and constitutional law in this country than any previous administration, that we just had to do something.
Well, the book deals with laws that are unjust laws that have been passed during the Bush administration, or laws that are just that have not been enforced to the protection of all U.S. citizens. An example of that has to do with Hurricane Katrina. The fact that in the case of Hurricane Katrina, there were already a number of laws on the books one being the Stafford Recovery Act, under which FEMA gets its mandate to come in and during a disaster. If those laws that were already on the books were enforced, the catastrophe that we saw, which was a policy failure on a drastic level, that would not have happened because the people's rights under those laws would have been observed. And then we see a number of other laws that have been created, taking away civil rights, civil liberties, taking away people's right to an attorney, etc., that really fly in the face of what living in a democracy in the 21st century should be about.
And it turned out that there are 67 different categories of bad laws that Bush and Cheney have pushed through, or good laws that they have refused to administer. So the book is called Undoing the Bush-Cheney Legacy, A Toolkit for Congress and Activists. And in it, we describe a law. And the first thing we do is give the name of the law or the Bush statement, where to find it, who is hurt by this law, what the law provides, what the law ignores, and what Congress can do about it.
There are many issues that a lot of people may not know about, such as signing statements. When a bill is passed through Congress, the president either signs the bill or vetoes it. Bush has surpassed every U.S. president by issuing 1,167 signing statements that challenge Congress's authority to act or asserts that the president will not enforce the law as written. For example, the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004 establishes a Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board to review the actions of the executive office. Bush signed the act, but issued a signing statement that the president will withhold information that would impair national security and the deliberative processes of the executive office. This signing statement ignores Article 2, Section 3 of the U.S. Constitution that requires the president to faithfully execute the laws of the land.
Another law that we have in the book, and we have 67 altogether, another that more people have heard about, is lifting habeas corpus, saying that no detainee has a right to habeas corpus. This is not what's in the Constitution. The Constitution is clear. You can only abolish habeas corpus in case of civil war or an invasion. We do not have either at this time. And Congress passed this law permitting what are called detainees to be held without habeas corpus. And the result is that there are hundreds of people still being held at Guantanamo and were held at Abu Ghraib under conditions that are absolutely unconstitutional.
They can find out what rights they have. And by finding out what rights they have, they'll be able to find out what rights are being violated, both on an individual and a collective level. Finding out what those rights are is really tantamount. That's part of being a responsible citizen. And it's also a part of ensuring that those who don't have the money, the power, and the prestige to buy influence within legislative or judicial quarters, that their rights are protected by the law.
Bush proposed and Congress has passed the No Child Left Behind Act, requiring all public schools to give lists and contact information of all their students. As a result, children as young as 11 years old are being approached and influenced by military recruiters at school, even though the U.S. has signed and ratified the Optional Protocol on Children in Armed Conflicts, requiring that states permit voluntary recruitment into their national armed forces, and requires it to be carried out with informed consent of the child's parents or legal guardian.
What I'll do with the book is, because I'm a public speaker and I do a lot of work on the issue of racism, I will look at the book with respect to the things that I can glean from it as I go around the country talking about racism and as I talk about proactive measures that people can take on a community and institutional basis to undo racism and thus undo some of these terrible laws that have been written with some, if not a racist intent, certainly a racist impact.
People in the United States are being affected by the bad laws Bush has pushed through. But the people in the United States are also going to be affected because people all over the world are going to say, The United States today is not a democratic country. We don't want to have an alliance with them. We don't want to work with them. We want to cause them not to be powerful because they are destroying democracy and human rights all over the world. And so for that reason, we put together this book. And in each case, there's something Congress can do to stop this. And that, I think, is why it's important. People can urge Congress members to do something about each of these bills. And I think that it is critical at this moment in history of this country, given the global nature of society, that people in the United States have something in their hand that they can hold, visit their Congress member, their senator or representative in Washington, or visit their aides at home and say, look, this is a law that you permitted Congress to pass, or this is a law that Bush has put into effect that needs to be stopped in 2009. It gives you exactly the information you need so that you can say, I'm not just talking in general. What are you going to do about signing statements that are illegal? What are you going to do about abolishing the Patriot Act, repealing the Patriot Act? What are you going to do about each of these laws that Bush and Cheney have pushed through? And I think that's the thing that's critical today, that people don't give up, they don't think there's nothing they can do, and they know specifically exactly what to propose.
Hey, that sounds pretty good. Inform yourself and make some intelligent decisions. I like that indeed. So, there we are. What we just heard was from the Micklejohn Civil Rights Institute. They published the book Undoing the Bush-Cheney Legacy. That book commercial was put out by Joseph Woodard Multimedia. Okay, let's move on now to an article by James Howard Kunstler. I've read from him before on this show. This article here is called We'll Never Be Happy Again. No stimulus package can bring that back. So a quick bio. James Howard Kunstler is an American author, social critic, public speaker. He's best known for his books The Geography of Nowhere, A History of American Suburbia and Urban Development, and the more recent The Long Emergency, where he argues that declining oil production is likely to result in the end of industrialized society as we know it and force Americans to live in localized agrarian communities. Now, I don't agree with everything that Mr. Kunstler has to say. I guess I'm more of a conspiracy theorist. I don't think things that are happening on the national level happen by accident, and that our politicians are ignorant to what's going on and how it's being done. I think that it is planned in most every case. You know, he suggests that the politicians, you know, are not in reality, and I disagree with him on that, but let's read this article and you can make up your own mind. So, We'll Never Be Happy Consumers Again, No Stimulus Package Can Bring That Back, by James Howard Kunstler. Published first at alternet.org. You can also visit kunstler.com. That's K-U-N-S-T-L-E-R, kunstler.com. This was printed or published February 10, 2009. So here we go. Venturing out each day into this land of strip malls, freeways, office parks, and MIC housing pods, one can't help but be impressed at how America looks the same as it did a few years ago, while seemingly overnight we have become another country. All the old mechanisms that enabled our way of life are broken, especially endless revolving credit at every level, from household to business to the banks to the U.S. Treasury. Peak energy has combined with the diminishing returns of overinvestments in complexity to pull the kill switch on our way of life, a set of agreements that we don't apologize for or negotiate. So, the big question before the nation is, do we try to restart the whole smoking, creaking, hopeless, futureless machine, or do we start behaving differently? The attempted restart of revolving debt consumerism is an exercise in futility. We've reached the limit of being able to create additional debt at any level without causing further damage, additional distortions, and new perversities of economy and of society, too. we can't raise credit card ceilings for people with no ability to make monthly payments. We can't promote more mortgages for people with no income. We can't crank up the home building industry with our massive inventory of unsold and overpriced houses built in the wrong places. We can't ramp back up the blue light special shopping fiesta. We can't return to the heyday of happy motoring, no matter how many bridges we fix or how many additional ring highways we build around our already overblown and oversprawled metroplexes. Mostly, we can't return to the now complete growth cycle of economic expansion. We're done with all that. History is done with our doing that for now. So far, after 2 weeks in office, the Obama team seems bent on a campaign to sustain the unsustainable at all costs, to attempt to do all the impossible things listed above. Mr. Obama is not the only one, of course, who is invoking the quest for renewed growth. This is a tragic error in collective thinking. What we really face is the comprehensive contraction of our activities, especially the scale of our activities, and the pressing need to readjust the system of everyday life to a level of decreased complexity. For instance, the myth that we can become energy dependent and yet remain car dependent is absurd. In terms of liquid fuels, we're simply trapped. We import two-thirds of the oil we use, and there is absolutely no chance that drill, drill, drilling or any other scheme will change that. The public and our leaders cannot face the reality of this. The great wish for alternative liquid fuels will never be anything more than a wish at the scales required. And the parallel wish to keep all our cars running by other means, hydrogen fuel cells, electric motors, is equally idle and foolish. We cannot face the mandate of reality, which is to do everything possible to make our living spaces walkable and connect them with public transit. The stimulus bill in Congress clearly illustrates our failure to understand the situation. Now, again, that's where we differ here. I don't think it's a failure of understanding. Carrying on with James Howard Kunstler. The attempt to restart consumerism will be equally disappointing. It was a manifestation of the short peak energy decades of history, and now that we're past peak energy, it's over. That 70% of the economy is over, especially the part that allowed people to buy stuff with no money. From now on, people will have to buy stuff with money they earn and save, and they will be buying a lot less. For a while, a lot of stuff will circulate through yard sales and Craigslist, and some resourceful people will get busy fixing broken stuff that still has value. But the other infrastructure of shopping is toast, especially the malls, the strip malls, and the real estate investment trusts that own it all. Washington is evidently seized by panic right now. I don't know anyone who works in the White House, but I must suppose that they have learned in 2 weeks that these systems are absolutely tanking, that the previous way of life that everybody was so set on not apologizing for has reached the end of the line. We seem to be learning a new and interesting lesson, that even a team that promises change is actually petrified of too much change, especially change that they can't control. And I, of course, Barack Obama won on that silly word change. And so Kunstler says the argument about change during the election was sufficiently vague, and no one was really challenged to articulate a future that wasn't materially more of the same. I suppose the Obama team may have thought they could only administer it differently than the Bush team, but basically life in the USA would continue being about all those trips to the malls and the cubicle jobs to support that, and the family safaris to visit Grandma in Lansing, and the vacations at SeaWorld, and Skipper's $20,000 college loan, and Dad's yearly junket to Las Vegas. to refinancing the house and rolling over this loan and that loan. And that has all led to a very dead end in a dark place. Okay, that's kind of a scary thought. A dead end in a dark place. Carrying on here. If this nation wants to survive without an intense political convulsion, there's a lot we can do, but none of it is being voiced in any corner of Washington at this time. We have to get off the petro-agriculture and grow our food locally at a smaller scale with more people working on it and fewer machines. This is an enormous project, which implies change in everything from property allocation, that's going to be a tough one, to farming methods, to new social relations. But if we don't focus on it right away, a lot of Americans will end up starving, and rather soon. We have to rebuild the railroad system in the U.S. and electrify it, and make it every bit as good as the system we once had that was the envy of the world. If we don't get started on this right away, we're screwed. We will have tremendous trouble moving people and goods around this continent-sized nation. We have to reactivate our small towns and cities because the metroplexes are going to fail at their current scale of operation. We have to prepare for manufacturing at a much smaller and local scale than the scale represented by General Motors. The political theater of the moment in Washington is not focused on any of this, but on the illusion that we can find new ways of keeping the old ways going. Many observers have noted lately how passive the American public is in the face of their dreadful accelerating losses. It's a tragic mistake to tell them that they can have it all back again. We'll see a striking illustration of phase change as the public mood goes from cow-like incomprehension to grizzly bear-like rage. Not only will they discover the impossibility of getting back to where they were, but they will see the panicked actions of Washington drive what remains of our capital resources down a rat hole. Down a rat hole. I have a feeling that that's where this is going. These bailout packages are such a scam. It makes me sick. You know, that kind of money, the industries that we could put together, you know, making, intelligent, sustainable choices. Man, oh man. Okay, this is the final paragraph here. And again, we're listening to James Howard Kunstler. And you can read about this at kunstler.com. So to conclude the article, a consensus is forming on each side of the stimulus question, largely along party lines, simply those who are for it and those who are against it, mostly by degrees. However, nobody in either party has a position for direct public resources and an effort at any of the things I mentioned above, future food security, future travel and transport security, or the future security of livable, walkable dwelling places based on local networks of economic interdependency. This striking poverty of imagination may lead to change that will tear the nation to pieces. So he's calling it a poverty of imagination that may well lead to tear the nation to pieces. I think we have to look at who's controlling these actions and the money behind them. And boy, what a tough predicament we're in right now. It's the more you learn, the more frustrating it becomes, it seems. I don't know. So there we are. That was James Howard Kunstler. The social critic, and his big thing is urban development, and the book I've read of his, The Long Emergency, was a fantastic read. I do recommend that. So let's carry on here. I have a movie review right now. This is for The Road to Guantanamo, and Guantanamo Bay, of course, is where they're holding a bunch of innocent people in this bogus war of terror. The review is by Jonathan Kim of Brave New Films. So we'll do that, and then we're going to come back for a campus community update. So I'll see you in 3 minutes, all right? You're listening to CHLY 101.7 FM.
There's a hook on the floor. The leg irons are attached to the hook. Then they put your hands between your ankles at the floor and chain you to the hook on the floor as well. Keep you there for like an hour, sometimes 2 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours. Can't go to the toilet. You have to urinate to defecate where you are.
Do you drink water?
Yeah.
Are you a member of Al-Qaeda?
No.
Have you met Osama bin Laden?
No.
Did you fight with the Taliban?
No.
The Road to Guantanamo tells the true story of three young Muslim Brits, later known as the Tipton Three. During a trip to Pakistan in late 2001, they took a detour into Afghanistan to assist with an aid mission and witnessed the American-led assault firsthand. They couldn't have known that they would be swept up in America's indiscriminate war on terror dragnet and later deposited in the legal and moral netherworld we know as Guantanamo Bay, where they were held without charge for 2 long years. I'll admit, I didn't get into this movie at first. That's because Road to Guantanamo is a curious hybrid of documentary and drama, using archival footage and interviews with the real Tipton Three mixed with documentary-style reenactments using mostly non-actors. There's nothing inherently wrong with this approach. I just prefer that my docs be docs and my dramas be dramas. But this style really pays off once the men are taken from Afghanistan to Guantanamo, because then we get to see recreations of how prisoners are actually treated there from the prisoner's perspective, something that no true documentary can achieve, regardless of what the Bush administration would have you believe from the sanitized dog and pony shows performed for visiting reporters and politicians. It's this part of the movie that really illustrates the cruelty, illegality, and insanity that is Guantanamo Bay and the war on terror, where innocent men are endlessly accused of being Al-Qaeda fighters and buddies with Osama bin Laden and the 9/11 hijackers, where men are kept in outdoor pens for months, forbidden to talk, stand, pray, or even make eye contact with guards. And then there's the torture. Regardless of what the Dick Cheneys and John Hughes of the world would say, being tied up for days with a bag over your head is torture. Being blindfolded and forced to kneel under the hot sun for hours is torture. Being chained to the floor in painful stress positions while death metal is blasted in your ears is torture. It's not the same as pulling out someone's fingernails, but destroying someone's mind is, without a doubt, a form of torture. If you think treatment like what you see in The Road to Guantanamo is just enhanced interrogation, I'd ask you this. What would you call it if you, a family member, or a captured American soldier was treated like this? And if you say that the Guantanamo prisoners deserve to be tortured because they're all dangerous terrorists, how come over 400 detainees, including the Tipton Three, have been released from Guantanamo without charge? How come in 7 years, only 2 detainees have ever been convicted of a crime, even with Bush's kangaroo military tribunals? Face it, the discussion about closing Guantanamo is over. Obama knows it. That's why he's promised to shut this monstrosity down. When that happens, hopefully all that will be left of it will be bad memories in movies like The Road to Guantanamo, reminders that we can't let fear turn us into a nation of criminals. This is Jonathan Kim for Brave New Films.
Are you getting all your B vitamins? I'm talking B for blues. I'm Lynn, your host of Blue Plate Special, serving up a healthy helping of blues every Thursday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Blue Plate Special, right here on CHLY 101.7 FM.
Hey, welcome back, friends. It's a little piggy song. That means it's campus community update. I played a Lynn Thompson's Blue Plate Special promo there. That's because tomorrow night I'm going to be the guest of that show. That's from 8 to 10, a blues show. And that's a lot of fun. That's going to be the first time that I've sat in as a guest DJ for a music show. And, you know, it's kind of funny. Music was I guess my first love, well, after baseball, I suppose. Baseball and then music. I was, and here I am. I have a radio show, but it's not a music show. That's kind of funny, but anyway, I do have a special announcement tomorrow night on the Blue Plate Special from 8 to 10 p.m. That's the same time as the show you're listening to right now. I'm going to be giving away a pair of tickets, and this is a pretty good way to lead into the campus community updates, for the following event. The pair of tickets are for the production at the Shemanis Theater. And there we are. That is our campus community update, and it is being brought to us by the regular financial contributors of this show and CHLY. They are the fine people at Victoria 911 Truth, Fraser Valley 911 Truth, and Edmonton 911 Truth. Okay, so where are we going to go next? We just did the movie review, Road to Guantanamo. Oh, yes, this is a good one. Countdown with Keith Olbermann. He is probably my favorite mainstream news person. He's on MSNBC. He's very critical of Bush, and not too many people are. And, Keith has done some fine stuff, and this is another one of them. But he's, well, moving on to putting the fire under Obama's feet, and he's asking, will Obama make the changes needed to return the states to what they used to be? You know, and we just heard from that piece, Undoing the Bush-Cheney Legacy. Well, this goes hand-in-hand with that segment. So here we are. Keith Olbermann and his guest is Professor of Constitutional Studies, Jonathan Turley. So give this a listen. And the following piece is going to be from Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur, Democrat from Ohio. This was originally aired on CNN. And what she's telling people to do, that the bank has said that, you foreclose on and you're losing your house. She's saying, don't leave your house until they can show you the ownership deed. And apparently that, you know, part of this problem is, this financial problem, is the transfer of ownership deeds. And it is not easy for the bank to find who has the original deed to the house. And that there's a good chance that you could be staying in your home for many months while they're trying to track down this piece of paper. And legally, it's all on the up and up. So, interesting stuff. I've read from Marcy Kaptur on the show before, so well done to this woman from Ohio. So, that's what you're going to get next. And there you go. We'll see you in a short while. Be well.
Last week we revealed on this news hour the allegations from a former NSA analyst that President Bush's National Security Agency targeted news organizations for surveillance and even pried into personal records like finance and travel. We asked the Obama White House for its response, and today in our third story we have it. Sort of. We asked the White House specifically what knowledge it now has about illegal NSA spying and what Mr. Obama will do about it. The response, as the president made clear last week, his administration is ensuring that all programs are conducted in accordance with our values and the rule of law. There will be no exceptions. The only faint echo of dissonance, Mr. Bush, too, insisted that all programs were conducted in accordance with our values and the rule of law. The bad news, that leaves us still reliant on the values of those entrusted with enforcing the rule of law. The good news, this time we have a better idea of the better values being brought to bear. Today, Politico.com reported that three Clinton veterans who opposed the excessive claim of war powers, Don Johnson, Martin Lederman, and David Barron, will now be running the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, the office intended to advise on legality rather than rubber stamp as it did under Mr. Bush. All of them that condemn the waterboarding rationales generated for Mr. Bush, but are not as uniform on other issues such as whether to prosecute torture. And still unknown is whether Mr. Obama will prosecute anybody at the NSA or higher for their illegal wiretaps, despite his pledge to follow evidence where it leads. And the awkward, inconvenient truth that, as of Wednesday's edition of this news hour, the entire nation has now heard all the evidence a prosecutor might want. Someone is guilty as hell. Joining us tonight on this issue, Jonathan Turley, professor of constitutional law at George Washington University. Thanks for your time again tonight, John.
Hi, Keith.
Let's rewind to the Obama statement. Programs in accordance with our values and the rule of law. How much daylight might there be between that and any of it, the analogs from the Bush White House?
Not much. First of all, it responds in the future tense. You weren't asking whether he would do these things. Nobody thinks that Obama is George Bush. I think we believe that he's better than these past programs, but people aren't asking about the future. They're asking about the past. It takes a lot to avoid a very simple truism that if true, these would be crimes, and we prosecute crimes. We call people criminals who commit them. It's very easy to say. All you need to have is the principles and the courage to say it.
The claims from Russell Tice, Mr. Bush's admission that he greenlit interrogations that included waterboarding, are these not exactly the kinds of evidence that Mr. Obama said his prosecutors would pursue?
He did. And what's troubling us is that he doesn't simply say the easiest possible thing. That's the conspicuous silence. The easiest thing is to say, I must prosecute war crimes because we have treaties that obligate us to do that. And any war crimes that we discover will be prosecuted. It's a very easy thing to say. It happens to be the law. And what really scares many of us is that nobody's saying that in the Obama camp.
Let's say some kind of prosecution ensues. How does it get decided whether it's the grunts who did the actual torturing and waterboarding and what else not who get pursued in this, or the people who told them to do it?
Well, Keith, I have very little sympathy for the people that committed this torture. I've heard President Obama say, you know, we don't want talented people at the CIA looking over their shoulders. Well, those talented people in this circumstance would be torturers. But in reality, nobody thinks that they're going to be prosecuted. They have something called an estoppel defense, where they can say that they were told by people like John Yoo and others that what they did was legal. That does not protect the president and vice president, and they're the ones and the people just below them who deserve to be investigated, and they must be prosecuted if they've committed war crimes, or we will shred four treaties and at least four statutes. And the problem here is that it wouldn't make Obama an apologist. It would make him an accessory. He would be preventing the investigation of war crimes. How could he go from that and say that he's all about the rule of law?
The three people heading to justice, according to Politico, Mr. Clinton also exceeded constitutional limits on his power, but through essentially loopholes rather than defiance in the outright sense. Should we care about that distinction?
Yeah. Well, I was no fan of the violations committed by Bill Clinton at the time. But there is a difference. There is a material difference. What George Bush did was unprecedented. He decided that he literally was beyond the law, that he became a government unto himself. He was wrong. The question, though, is whether the Obama administration will now stand by the law wherever it takes him, and that includes possibly to his predecessor. If his predecessor violated the law and particularly committed war crimes, it's going to be something that defines Obama's administration on whether he will stand in the way of the enforcement of those laws.
Lastly, John, tangentially connected to this at best, the issue of politicizing the Justice Department, specifically the firing of the U.S. attorneys, and the House Judiciary Committee today subpoenaed Karl Rove to testify. I seem to recall they've done that before, and the Justice Department sort of just ignored it. Is there a chance this Justice Department is going to enforce that subpoena?
You know, Keith, I think this is one of the most fascinating things that has happened since Obama took the oath, or took it again. And that is that his administration is the one that invokes executive privilege. If he says there is no executive privilege here, we could have an interesting fight where George Bush comes in and says, I'm still claiming executive privilege, when the current president is saying we don't recognize it. Indeed, Obama's people could prosecute Rove and others, and I think that the federal courts would give much greater rate to the man that's currently in that Oval Office than the guy that just left it.
Yeah, the current executive is the one who gets to decide what executive privilege is. Jonathan Turley of George Washington University. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Keith.
Welcome back to the most news in the morning. As job cuts and the housing crisis catch more and more homeowners in the crossfire, mortgages and defaults are skyrocketing. But one congresswoman says she's sick of bailouts for Wall Street and nothing for the folks who might soon be living on Main Street. She's telling her constituents to become squatters in their own homes. Drew Griffin has the story.
The notices came to her home in April. Andrea Geis's bank foreclosed on her. Behind in payments, out of work, a husband sick, she had nowhere to go. So she decided to follow the advice of her congresswoman and go nowhere. Geis is part of a new movement in the housing crisis, squatters.
For lack of a better term, you're kind of squatting in this house, aren't you?
Basically, yeah.
More than 4,000 properties were foreclosed on in Toledo's Lucas County last year. This year, it could be worse. Elected officials are saying Toledo is not in a recession, it is a depression. It is this bleak backdrop that inspired Toledo Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur to take the floor of the House earlier this month to tell her constituents to stay put.
So I say to the American people, you'll be squatters in your own homes. Don't you leave.
Kaptur says she has had it with government bailouts for Wall Street banks, but nothing for homeowners. She is advocating for a legal revolution, a demand that not one of her constituents leaves their home without an attorney and a fight.
Even if they've been foreclosed on, don't leave.
If they've had no legal representation of a high quality, I shall have them stay in their homes.
Kaptur is behind a strategy called Produce the Note. Mortgages have been so divvied up on Wall Street that banks are having a hard time finding that original paperwork, adding a delay to foreclosures. She is also pushing banks to rework loans, especially those banks getting bailouts and holding mortgages of folks getting tossed out.
They're vultures. They prey on our property assets. And I guess the reason I'm so adamant on this is because I know property law and its power to protect the individual homeowner. And I believe that 99.9% of our people have not had good legal representation in this.
Without a lawyer, Andrea Geis bought a $147,000 home with nearly $40,000 down.
I should have had an attorney. I really should have had the attorney. I did not know.
She admits she didn't read the paperwork, didn't learn, until it was too late. She had a subprime loan. Her payments of $883 a month jumped in a year to more than $1,500. When it did, she stopped paying.
So they foreclosed on me.
They have foreclosed on me.
So what do the banks say? Well, the law firm representing the bank in Geis's foreclosure declined comment. Another one of the banks Geis believes holds her note, Wells Fargo, Kieran, said it wouldn't comment on individual cases but tries to work with homeowners. Well, now that homeowner, backed by her congressman, Kieran, is simply not budging.
It is, and it's a situation that we see replayed all over the country. The other thing is people say they have been having trouble as they try to reach out, make contact, and figure out if there's some way to rework their loan.
Yeah, in many cases, you just can't talk to the person. You get in these phone trees, or you're dealing with brokers who are working for the loans. It's very, very difficult to get through the red tape.
Wow. Very interesting stuff. We'll see if the congresswoman gets other support from her colleagues as well. Drew Griffin, thanks so much.
Okay, there we are. There's a rare example of CNN doing their job, reporting some important information to the public. So there we are, a piece on Marcy Kaptur, congresswoman from Ohio. Before that, we heard Keith Olbermann and Jonathan Turley, a professor of constitutional studies. We're going to move on now to another clip from a documentary movie. This one is called The Heartbeat of America. The director is Stephen Talbot. From 1993, it was produced for PBS Frontline by the Center for Investigative Reporting. And what we're looking at here is, is it coincidence or conspiracy? Well, you better bet it's a conspiracy. This is on how the streetcars were replaced by automobiles. Yes, indeed, the big moneyed interests got together and said, let's make some changes and let's make a shitload of money while we're doing it. So that's what we're going to hear next. That's going to be followed, it'll likely be the final piece of the night, an audio piece of Scott Ritter talking about, well, new president, same bullshit, Iran and nuclear weapons. So let me tell you who Scott Ritter is. He is noted for his role as a chief UN weapons inspector in Iraq from 1991 to 98, and later for his criticism of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. prior to the U.S. invasion in Iraq, of Iraq in March 2003. Ritter publicly argued that Iraq possessed no significant weapons of mass destruction. Of course, he has become a popular anti-war figure due to his stance. So, fantastic. So let's hear a little bit about the car industry in America and then this new president. And, well, things aren't looking very good there, are they? So there we go. That will likely do it for tonight's episode of Unbought and Unbossed. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll do it again next week. And, yeah, that's about all I have to say, friends. Okay, take care of yourself, and we'll do it again next week. Goodbye.
Once upon a time, Los Angeles was not shrouded in smog. It had one of the best electric streetcar systems in the country. But the electric trolleys disappeared, and that was no accident.
Streetcar didn't fail because of demographics or economics. It failed because General Motors killed it.
What happened in Los Angeles happened in many cities. General Motors conspired with oil and tire companies to dismantle electric trolley lines across America.
The whole concept came from General Motors. They would go in, they'd buy a street railway system, they'd convert it to General Motors buses, the General Motors buses would run on Firestone tires, and they'd be fueled by in the East Phillips and in the West Standard Oil California. It was a great, great scheme. It was a tremendous scheme for selling a very large amount of automotive products.
In 1947, the federal government charged General Motors and its partners with criminal conspiracy.
The result, however, was that General Motors was fined $5,000. And its key official, who was an assistant secretary of General Motors, one of the people who was intimately involved in this whole operation, was fined the magnanimous sum of $1. Right. Now, you got to compare that with the damage that was done. Los Angeles today is trying to begin rebuilding its rail system, right? And their fondest projection is that perhaps in 20 years, they'll be able to rebuild at least part of it at a cost of $150 billion. And this is a legacy of what, you know, of what GM left us with.
Can't get all their centrifuges to work properly because they have a problem with ball bearings and magnets that are used in the rotors. They imported some so they could do a couple of these centrifuges in research and development, but when they want to expand the program, not to 3,000, to 164, they can't get 164 to work because they don't have enough ball bearings and magnets. But even if they get them to work, the uranium hexafluoride that is produced in Iran is derived from uranium in Iran that is contaminated with a substance called molybdenum. It's an element. You go to the brittle hybrid. And the molybdenum is used in steel alloys and things like that. But it's in the uranium, and you don't extract it. When you create uranium hexafluoride gas and you put that gas into the centrifuge, that molybdenum has a mass. And when you start spinning the centrifuge up to 70,000 RPM, that mass is exaggerated. And what happens is that mass grabs onto the side of the centrifuge and blows the centrifuge apart. When the Iranians operate their cascades for any duration of time, every single time the cascade self-destructs. Now, this president's trying to tell us that we are at imminent risk from the Iranians, that this nuclear program represents a real and imminent threat to the security of the United States of America. The vice president is creating a sense of urgency. The media is hyping up that we're 1 year away from a nuclear-armed Iran. I'm telling you right now, A, even if they had a covert nuclear weapons program, which no one has demonstrated they have, they couldn't build a nuclear weapon if they wanted to. They just don't have the technological capacity. How do we know all this? From the inspectors. Contrary to popular belief, Iran has not kicked out the inspectors. Iran is operating 100% in compliance with its legal obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Iran is permitted under Article 4 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty to enrich uranium. We are demanding that Iran to deny that which is legally allowed to do when we say they must suspend their enrichment programs. Iran agreed to the safeguards inspections. They have inspectors in place. We have demanded that Iran allow additional protocols and inspections, increased inspection activity, which the Iranians have said they're willing to do so long as, at the end of the day, the United States respects Iran's legal right to enrich uranium as part of a nuclear energy program, which we refuse to do. But even more than this, you know, we're told the Iranians are picking a fight. Get into that discussion. They're searching for a conflict with us. They're trying to be expansions. Ladies and gentlemen, study your history. Iran fought an 8-year war with Iraq. Hundreds of thousands of Iranians were killed. Their economy was devastated. They are just beginning to recover from that, and they are going through a serious economic period of difficulty as we speak, with high unemployment. This nation awash in a sea of oil spends $30 billion a year to import gasoline because they don't have a refining capacity to produce indigenous gasoline. They're not looking for a fight. The last thing they want is a fight with the world's sole remaining superpower. Fact is, in 2003, they went so far as to send a 2-page message to the United States government saying, we don't want to fight. We will do whatever necessary to normalize relations. We are willing to put our nuclear program on the table. Give it up. We are willing to rein in Hamas and Hezbollah, to deny them funding, to put pressure on them to stop their activities against Israel. We are willing to recognize Israel's right to exist. All we ask from you, the United States, is that you lift the embargo and you recognize our right to exist. You give us security guarantees that you will no longer pursue a policy of regime change when it comes to the Islamic Republic of Iran. The Bush administration rejected this, and they've gone so far as to have Condoleezza Rice just recently lie to the American people, saying she doesn't believe it. Nobody else in the White House remembers this document, but Condi Rice has a convenient lapse of memory. The most important diplomatic initiative to come this way in modern times, and she forgot about it. She forgot. Ladies and gentlemen, the Iranians are not pushing for a conflict. They don't want to fight. This is a war that does not need to be fought. But if you read the policies of this administration, a lot of people say, well, we're usually being pretty presumptive here, saying that the Bush administration wants a war. I'm not being presumptive. Read the March 2006 version of the National Security Strategy of the United States of America. Again, we're in the library. Go, I'm sure you guys have got internet terminals. It's not hard. This is not classified CIA information here. Go log in, type in National Security Strategy, March 2006. You'll get the document. Read for yourself what it says. It lists Iran no fewer than 16 times as representing the number one threat in the world to the security of the United States of America. It says this threat comes in the form of two ways. One, a nuclear weapons program. I just told you there isn't one. The international community concurs that there is no evidence whatsoever to sustain the allegations that Iran is pursuing nuclear weapons. All they say is that because the United States has flunked the possibility of it, the current inspection regime is incapable of giving 100% assurance that somewhere, somehow, in Iran, there might be a nuclear weapons program. Well, that's not what the inspections are about. The inspections are not about going everywhere on a wild goose chase to try and prove the negative. The inspections are about chasing down fact and coming up with a conclusion that is derived from fact, not speculation. And the conclusion is there is no nuclear weapons program in Iran today. The CIA actually concurs with that. They indirectly state it when they note that Iran is 10 years away from developing nuclear weapons. 10 years, ladies and gentlemen, in this modern day and age, means Iran's not doing anything. Any nation in the world today is 10 years away from developing nuclear weapons. But the document also says, and this is where it gets scary, ladies and gentlemen, that even if Iran is not pursuing nuclear weapons, Iran represents a threat because it is the largest state sponsor of terror in the world today. Now, that term, terror, is very important. A lot of people say, hey, the Democrats came in and got the Congress, whether that's good or bad in your opinion, so be it. You know, we all voted, and that's the will of the people. Democrats now have the Congress of the United States, and that people are saying it was an anti-war vote to put them in, and that these newly empowered Democrats are going to do the right thing and not only get us out of Iraq, but prevent a war in Iran. Wrong answer. First of all, there's only one way to prevent a war in Iran. wants to pass a new Boland Amendment today that denies funding for any military activity, covert or overt. Go back to Congress. No. Read very carefully the War Powers Authorization Resolution of September 2001 and the War Powers Authorization of October 2002. Read the fine print when it talks about terrorism, when it talks about nations, organizations, individuals who are giving harbor support or otherwise condoning terrorism. They are now a free target. The president in the national security strategy of the United States has defined Iran as not just a state sponsor of terror, but the state sponsor of terror. Did you listen to his State of the Union address?
Yes.
His State of the Union address, using the same sleight of hand where he took Saddam Hussein, a secular dictator, and made him allied with Osama bin Laden, an Islamic fundamentalist Wahhabist who had been involved and engaged in active conflict with Saddam Hussein, and now that they're allies. He did the same thing. Al-Qaeda, a Wahhabist Sunni-based terrorist organization, and made it one and the same with the Shia in Iran, rejecting centuries of history that say that the Sunni view the Shia as apostates, especially Wahhabist Sunnis who will never have anything to do with the Shia. But Bush made them one and the same, so that the global war on terror has now, with one magic wave of the wand, been expanded to include Iran. And Iran has been now defined as part of what they call the Shia Crescent, which extends from Lebanon through Iraq into Iran, threatening the security of the entire world. We have the Saudis buying into this. We have the Egyptians buying into this. We have the Jordanians buying into this. And believe it or not, we have our own Congress buying into this. Well, I say buying into it, because I'd like to believe that when you buy into something, it means you have an informed opinion. But Nancy Pelosi has just selected a representative from Texas, Congressman Reyes, to be the head of the Intelligence Committee. He was doing a pop quiz recently. What's the difference between a Sunni and a Shia? Yeah, no clue. Now, this is the man who's heading the Intelligence Committee. They said, well, Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, are they Sunni or Shia? He said, oh, their name is Shia. No, they're exclusively Sunni. This is a problem, ladies and gentlemen, because we can laugh at riots, but the bottom line is we each look in the mirror and reflect on our own personal level of comprehension. We all fail the pop quiz. There might be a handful of us that could pass it. But again, I'm a big believer in blaming the president when blame is due. I believe in holding Congress accountable for their abrogation of constitutional responsibility. I condemn the media for their irresponsible.
Never
we, the people of the United States of America.